Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, the existence of God, part one. For more information and resources, go to reasonablefaith.org.
What we now want to do is interrupt our study of Christian doctrine and take a little excursus, a little side trip, to look at some apologetic issues raised by the subject of God's existence. Up to this point, what we've been doing might be called revealed theology. We've been studying the nature and attributes of God on the basis of His revelation in Scripture. What I now like to do with you is several weeks of what's called natural theology. That is to say, arguments and evidence for the existence of God that are not taken from Scripture, but are taken from the data of human experience independent of God's self-revelation in Scripture. Natural theology was once the high point of much of medieval philosophical thought. But since the Enlightenment, natural theology as a project has been largely eclipsed until the late 20th century. And now it's started to enjoy a renaissance of interest. One manifestation of this would be the recent Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology that I told you about, published in Oxford by Blackwell, of a defense of some 11 different arguments for God's existence. And among contemporary philosophers, there's a tremendous movement in natural theology to redefend and refurbish various arguments for the existence of God. And what I'd like to do with you is to look at five such arguments for God's existence that I have worked on myself and that I find persuasive. I think these are good reasons to believe that God exists. Now, before we begin to do that, however, let me say a word about what makes for a good argument. By an argument, I don't mean a quarrel or a fight. Rather, when philosophers talk about an argument, what they mean is a series of statements or premises which logically lead to a conclusion. So an argument is a series of statements or premises leading to a conclusion. And the arguments that I'm going to be giving are deductive arguments. Now, what are the conditions for an argument being a good deductive argument? Well, first of all, it must obey the rules of logic. A good argument must obey the rules of logic. That is to say, its conclusion must follow from the premises by the rules of logic. If it doesn't, then that isn't a good argument. The premises don't prove the conclusion. So a good argument will be one in which the conclusion follows from the premises by the rules of logic. Secondly, the premises need to be true. The premises need to be true. It's not enough to have good logic. You also need to have true premises. So those are the two conditions for an argument being what is called sound. A sound argument will be one that has true premises and it obeys the rules of logic. If the premises are true and the argument obeys the rules of logic, then the conclusion will follow necessarily from the premises. But it's not enough for an argument to be sound. There's one more factor that needs to be included. The premises need in some way to be evident to us. They need to be in some way supported by the evidence so that they're not simply true, but somehow we know them to be true, or we have good reason to think that they're true, something of that sort. If they're true, but nobody has any idea that they're true, then this isn't really a good argument. So it seems to me that the third condition that is required is that the premises are more plausible than their opposites. Premises are more plausible than their negations or their contradictions. Or that the premise is more plausibly true than false. That would be another way of saying it. Now that's important because it means that in a good argument, the premises don't need to be certain. You don't need to have 100% certainty that the premises are true. The premises simply need to be more plausible than their negations. the premise needs to be more plausibly true than false. So even if it's just, say, 52% versus 48%, you should go with the one that has the greater plausibility. And that will be a good argument. And the arguments that I'm going to share with you, I believe, meet all three of these conditions. They are logically valid, they have true premises, and I think at least that the premises are more plausibly true than their negations. Now, you can feel free to disagree with me. Unlike revealed theology, natural theology doesn't fall from heaven. These arguments are human constructs. I could be wrong. I may have made a mistake. And so if the argument is unconvincing to you, that's just fine. That's okay. I think they're good arguments, and I hope you will too, but you feel free to assess them in your own right. And if you think that they fail to meet one of these conditions, then you can say that's not a good argument. Any question or comment then about what makes for a good argument before we look at the first of these? Yes.
Bill, I understand what you're saying about applied to, say, philosophy in general or politics even.
Yes.
But isn't it a problem that the non-believer or the atheist or the non-Christian doesn't follow this but puts the test on that it has to be 100%? In other words, says if it's 52-48, that's fine, but if it's not 100, it's nothing.
That is true, that very, very often unbelievers do that. But what you could point out to them is that insofar as they hold knowledge to that sort of standard, they will be skeptical about virtually anything, because there's almost nothing that we know with that kind of certainty. When you think about it, we don't even have 100% certainty that the external world is real. You could be a brain in a vat of chemicals wired up with electrodes by a mad scientist to think you're here in the Defenders class listening to this lecture. The scientist could even be stimulating your brain to think that it would be crazy for you to think that you're a brain in a vat. So that kind of standard is simply unrealistic, and the unbeliever doesn't hold himself to that standard. For example, these sorts of arguments work in everyday life. Here would be an argument. If it's Sunday, the library is closed. It's Sunday, therefore the library is closed. Now, that would give you a good reason for not going to try to return your book today to the library, knowing that it's Sunday. And yet, it's not absolutely certain that it's Sunday. Maybe somehow you got mixed up on the days, or maybe the library is having a special opening on Sunday. Maybe it's not true that it's closed. So everything that we do is going to be based upon weighing the evidence for and against something and then making a judgment. And rationality would require us to go with the judgment that is the more plausible of the two. It would be irrational to go with the less plausible judgment. So we simply need to help the unbeliever to see that this is not something that we are constructing for arguments for God's existence. These are general conditions for just living life. And there's nothing special pleading about this for natural theology. Any other comment about the argument? Yes, Tom.
Why do you need 2 and 3? It seems like if you've got number 2 covered, why do you need more than that? Why do you need number 3 on top of
that? Well, because the premises could be true, but it would be true unbeknownst to you. For example, it may be true that on April 5th, 1805, Napoleon Bonaparte spat in a puddle. That could be true, but I have absolutely no idea whether it's true or not. So you see, it's not enough just for the premise to be true. You got to have some kind of warrant for believing the premise, for it to be a good argument. So that's the idea. Now, how much warrant does it need to be certain? 100% certainty? Obviously not. Then we'd be skeptics about everything. We couldn't even live life. Does it need to be probable? Well, I don't think it even needs to be probable. It simply needs to be more probable than its negation. It needs to be more probably true than false. And that would give you warrant for believing that it's true. So that would be, I think, why you need both of those. Any other question about what makes for a good argument? Ben? Yes.
kind of restating it, we're not just setting up, well, this looks logical. We're setting up what is something that ought to be convincing.
Yes.
Yeah. So that we're kind of restating, which is really what we're getting at, because you can set up a sort of an ideal argument as though it has to, you know, which is kind of what the our opponents might do with these arguments. They say it has to be 100%, but we're not going for that. We're going for this set of arguments most likely is going to be convincing, whereas you might have a set of arguments that were perfectly true, but if the person we're presenting this to has no way of really, you know, on the third one, has no of really way of really seeing that this is likely true, as an argument, it's ineffective.
This is meant to be practical and realistic and has nothing to do, as I say, with theology. This is just general conditions for a good argument. And it can be an argument for having a barbecue, an argument for going to the grocery store or watching a movie. And if our lives are to be guided by reason, then we can't set the standard so unreasonably high that we don't have good reasons for doing anything. We need to have realistic standards for rationally guiding what we believe and our behavior. And I think that this provides that. All right. Well, now with that in mind, let's turn to the first argument that I'd like to talk about, which is a version of the cosmological argument for God's existence, sometimes called the argument from contingency. When I was a boy growing up in a little town in Iowa, you could look up at the sky at night and see the stars brightly lit against the black sky. You could see the stars very clearly at night in Keokuk, Iowa. And as I would look up at the stars, I had a deep sense inside that all of this had to come from somewhere. As I looked at the universe, I thought, why does this exist? Where did it come from? There must be an explanation for why all of this exists. And therefore, as long as I can remember, I've always believed in God as a creator of the universe. And it was only many, many years later, as I began to study philosophy, that I discovered that my childish insight was one that is also shared by many of the world's greatest philosophers. For example, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz was a prodigious intellect of 17th century Europe, the inventor of the infinitesimal calculus, and one of the world's great thinkers. And Leibniz said, and I quote, "The first question which should rightly be asked is, why is there something rather than nothing?" This is the most fundamental question in Leibniz's view. Why is there something rather than nothing? In other words, why does anything at all exist? And Leibniz, like me, came to the conclusion that the answer is to be found not in the universe of contingent things around us, but rather in God. God exists necessarily and is the explanation for why anything else exists. Now, we can put Leibniz's thinking into the form of a very simple argument that goes like this. Number one, everything that exists has an explanation. Everything that exists has an explanation of its existence. Two, if the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is God. And three is the premise the universe exists. Now, what follows from these simple premises? Well, if everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, as premise one states, and the universe exists, as premise three states, then it follows that the universe has an explanation of its existence. And from that statement, and two, if the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is God, it therefore follows that the explanation of the existence of the universe is God. So, from this very simple argument, we derive the existence of God as the explanation for the existence of the universe. Now, this is a logically airtight argument. That is to say, it obeys the rules of logic. If the premises are true, then the conclusion follows necessarily. It doesn't matter if you don't like the conclusion. It doesn't matter if you have other reasons for thinking the conclusion is false. As long as the premises are true, it follows logically and necessarily that God is the explanation of the existence of the universe. So the whole debate comes down to the question, are the premises true? Are they more plausibly true than false? Well, premise three, I think, is undeniable for anybody who's a sincere seeker after truth. Again, we're not talking here about academic skepticism. We're talking about someone who really is wanting to find out the truth about the world. That the universe exists is obviously true. So it comes down to one and two. Are premises one and two more plausibly true or false? If you think they are more plausibly true than false, then this will be a good argument for God's existence. Now, before we look at those premises, let me ask if there are any questions so far about the formulation of the argument. Yes, David, over here.
In the first premise, doesn't that still leave open the possibility that the universe exists because of its own nature?
Yes, and I'm going to talk about that later on. We'll explore that possibility. So hang on to that. I'm just introducing it at this point.
Bill, I'm a little bit confused here. It almost sounds like you're not dealing, when you say truth, you're not dealing with absolute truth. Are you dealing with absolute truth here or not?
I am dealing with absolute truth in the sense of objective truth. Something is either true or it's false, independent of whether you think so or not. But when I'm talking about something being plausibly true, I'm talking about what do we have good reason to think is true. For example, if Dave Sherrill were to write some quantum mathematical equation here on the whiteboard, it might be true, but we wouldn't have any idea whether or not that equation was true or not. We might not have a clue. And so you can have objective truth, but you can be ignorant of it. And you might say, well, if David says it's true, that makes it plausible that it is true because he wouldn't say otherwise and he's skilled at this. So if he says it's true, that gives me a good reason to think that this is true. So that's plausibly true. Now, obviously, that's not to say that the truth isn't objective. It's to say you have some plausible reasons for thinking that it is true. Maybe we could reword it by, instead of saying it's plausibly true, we can say, plausibly, it is true. See what I mean? That's what I mean. I don't mean to say it's a different kind of truth. The adverb there, plausibly, it is true. It means it's modifying the is, not the true, not the adjective true. Plausibly, this is true. So seems to me plausibly, these two statements are true. And that's more plausible than that they're false. That's a good question, clarification. Yeah, Dennis?
How would you respond to a skeptic that says that number two begs the question? In other words, if the universe has an explanation, that's
well, we'll get to that. Okay. We'll get to that. I'm asking now here if we merely have any comprehension-type questions. I'm going to look at the objections to each of these and then attempt to answer how the typical atheist would respond to this. But I just want to lay out the argument first to be sure that you understand it before we begin to explore it. But certainly we're going to go into this now in more depth.
Yeah, I can imagine Richard Dawkins turning up his nose at number two, you know, without even thinking.
Well, I think you might be surprised at that, Dennis. I think you might be surprised to think that Dawkins would likely agree with two. But we'll hold off on that. Okay, one more question, and then we'll be out of time.
From an argument standpoint, why aren't three and two reversed? In other words, it looks to me like the sequencing.
Yes, a very good question. In an argument, it doesn't matter what order you present the premises in. So you could start off with three. The universe exists. Two, everything that exists has an explanation of its existence. And then, you know, the next one. The order is irrelevant. I probably did it this way simply because I think that three is so obviously true, you just kind of throw it in at the end, and the real debate is going to hang on these first two, so let's talk about them. But the order is irrelevant. The rules of logic will simply say from one and three, it follows that four, or from two and three, it follows that five, or something of that sort. It doesn't matter what order that they're in. You just apply the rules to the premises, and you derive your conclusion. Does everybody see, though, how the conclusion does follow from these premises, if they are true? That the universe exists, everything that exists has an explanation, therefore the universe has an explanation. If the universe has an explanation, then its explanation is God. I hope you can at least see the logic of how the argument works. Now the question will be, are premises 1 and 2 more plausibly true than false, or is there a problem with these, as some of you have already suggested? So that's what we'll talk about next Sunday.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.